So if you just tuned in, this is the ever interesting Thursday afternoon show with Ellen Thurston and Tom DiPietro. And we have a guest, Ellen.
Yes, we do.
Right off the bat, we have a guest.
Yep. We're welcoming Lindsay Lusher Shute, who's the executive director and the co-founder of the National Young Farmers Coalition that is housed right here, the offices are, the headquarters are, in Hudson, New York.
You mean a national organization has its headquarters right here in little old Hudson?
That's right.
Is that true, Lindsay?
That is absolutely true. We're in the old Register Star Jail, City Hall, Theater building right next to Hudson Home.
And you're...
moved in September. We've been in the area for a while, but this is our new headquarters.
How did it end up here in this region, in Hudson specifically?
Well, the organization was founded by three farmers in the Hudson Valley. Myself, Ben, my husband, and Severin Fleming, who used
I know Severin.
Okay, great. She used to have a radio show here long ago. And so the three of us were all starting our farms here in the Hudson Valley and realized that as young farmers, we needed to organize together to overcome the structural obstacles that we were facing in building successful farms here. And so we brought this idea actually to a national audience of young farmers in our network and beyond. And there was a resounding yes and interest in building a coalition of young and beginning farmers to advocate, particularly on policy in the last farm bill. And so we formed the National Young Farmers Coalition right here. And it's a great location because we're really still in farm country here. There are a lot of multi-generational, very successful farms and a lot of new farmers here in the Hudson Valley, but we can also get around pretty easily to the city. And we have offices in DC and also in Colorado. We have about 20 staff overall, and half of those staff are based here in Hudson.
Now, is this the organization that at one point was on the corner of Warren and Park or 7th?
That was the Greenhorns.
That was the Greenhorns.
Yes,
right,
that's right. They had sort of an installation here.
Okay, that was not
for a while.
That's not the same group.
That's a sister organization of Young Farmers Coalition.
Because I remember Severin was a big part of that.
That's right. She's the driving force of that organization. Mm-hmm.
So this is nationally... say Colorado, D.C., is that like for a lobbying presence or is just...
That's right. Yep. We have two staff that are in D.C. and they primarily work on national policy. So that's moving bills in Congress. We've been part of introducing now three or four marker bills for the next farm bill, advocating on the Affordable Care Act is something we worked on extensively in support of the ACA this summer. And then working with the administration and the USDA directly on how their programs are being implemented at the local level, because oftentimes very important change can be just made administratively without congressional approval.
Where's your office in Colorado?
Well, we actually have three different staff in Colorado, Denver and Durango. They go back and forth. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I have relatives there. That's why I was thinking I would pay a visit if I were ever out there.
Really?
Yeah.
That's nice of you. So the national organization links young farmers throughout the country. And how does one become involved? I mean... Is it an organization you pay dues to, or do you seek out the members? I mean, how does the whole thing work?
Right. So we're a membership organization, mm-hmm. and we have members in all 50 states. We currently have 40 chapters of the National Young Farmers Coalition in 28 states. So we have a very active chapter right here in the Hudson Valley, the Hudson Valley Young Farmers Coalition. We also have a Catskill chapter and an Adirondack chapter of Young Farmers Coalition. And it is a membership organization, so people do pay an annual dues.
Do you get kicked out if you turn 40?
No, we have members of, I'm going to be out like in a year and a half then, I suppose. If that were the case, we have members of all ages, And it's a very supportive community of people that wants to help the next generation of farmers succeed. And the core sort of mission and goal of the coalition is to ensure that people can choose farming as a first career, essentially, that you can start farming in your 20s or maybe early 30s even, and really be able to build a career starting then that will last a lifetime. It's too often that people just don't have a way in their 20s or 30s to be able to find that piece of affordable land or just really a place to start. And so people, you know, look to other careers, or sometimes they retire into farming. This is all fine on its own, you know, in its own right. But really, to have a successful farm and agricultural sector, you need young people to be very engaged, because when you're in your 20s, you can really be an entrepreneur in agriculture and, you know, have the back and the knees and sort of the time and the energy to really build a farm, which is a career that takes a ton of effort, particularly at the outset.
Sure.
So you decided to do a survey of young farmers beyond your members, or just through of the members of the organization?
Right. So in 2011, we did our first survey, of a national survey of young and beginning farmers, right when the coalition started. And just a couple of weeks ago, right after Thanksgiving, we released our second national survey, Building a Future of Farmers 2. And it is a national survey of young and beginning farmers under 40. And it is 3,500 farmers from all across the country, and not exclusive to our members. We worked with 94 partner organizations to help get the survey out to farmers in every region of the country.
You define your group partly by age, obviously, but do you also define it in terms of size? I mean, can a young farmer conceivably be somebody who has like a huge farm that's almost, you know, like if somebody was going into what they call agribusiness, would that person have any interest in a group like this?
I would hope so. I'd hope they would find solidarity with some of the work that we're doing. We try not to specify the kind of farm or kind of farming that we're supporting.
Right.
The idea is that we are supporting all young people in agriculture and making farming economically viable. In the United States right now, really 0.1% of the population is feeding most of us, right?
Right.
These are family scale farms. And if you look at the numbers, the ages of those farmers, it's about 36,000 of those farmers, of those family farmers, 36,000 young people who fit that. They're making more than $50,000 a year, grossing more than $50,000 a year in agriculture. So there are very few young people farming, and we really need to find ways to support all of them.
I remember reading once that Thomas Jefferson said something like you needed, I can't remember if it's 3 or 6 acres for an average family to have a farm and succeed. Now, what would you say today? I mean, that's a different family model too, obviously. So what do you need today to actually make a living as a small farmer? How many acres would you need?
Well,
you think in
general?
That's
a tough question, and totally depends on the type of farming that you do. We have farms that are highly efficient, and farmers that are actually making a decent living on 1 acre, which seems kind of incredible, but you know, I've seen it in action. But then we have other farmers, particularly in the Western United States, that are you know, have livestock and they're using public lands, operating at thousands of acres, right? And so it really very much depends on the context,
on the region,
like
a livestock can graze on public lands, so they don't have to invest the same amount of money and all that kind of thing.
Well, it very much depends on, in the Western United States, of course, they don't have sort of necessarily the lush pastures that we do. So, you know, the land doesn't have the same carrying capacity necessarily as we might have here in the Northeast. So, they will graze over a larger area of tract of land in some cases, or they just have more animals. They just, you know, they have a business model that either in some cases they're multi-generational farmers and their families have scaled over generations to this size. But, you know, farms that are inheriting, farmers that are inheriting businesses from other generations have unique challenges as well.
What's the key to making it? I mean, it's a key to have, let's say there are a number of farms around here that have direct access to restaurants in the city. Mm-hmm. Do they have a better chance of making a good living, or can you really survive just selling locally and keeping everything very local?
Well, again, there are many different models, mm-hmm. and
they all
I
work.
Think the
they
the
all
fact
can work.
They all can work. The farmers in this region certainly have a great market in New York City, but it is a difficult one for some farmers to access. Like the restaurant market can be a little bit challenging. If you want to sell direct and not through a distributor, then you have to develop relationships. You have to be growing things that are highly specific, and there's some degree of risk in that because you know, maybe they make a menu change, or maybe you know your produce isn't as good looking as it should be.
Yeah,
you
sure.
know? And then the New York City chefs have a very, very high standard
sure.
of what they want to see. So, I mean, there are great direct markets, whether it's CSA, farmers markets, chefs at restaurants that are all generally doing their part to support the farm community. I think more than market access in this region, I think the key thing is access to affordable land, and that across the country through first generation and multi-generational farmers, that is by far the biggest challenge and is a significant hurdle here in the Hudson Valley.
Are there a lot of existing farms that let's say they don't have a family member who wants to inherit, that they put their farms in trust to make sure it stays farmland? Is that a successful model?
Well, farmland conservation is critical in a region like the Hudson Valley and in Columbia County, where there is pressure from developers who may want to divide up viable farmland and make it into a housing development or commercial development or whatnot. So that farmland conservation is absolutely critical. And it does help to some degree to help make the farmland more affordable to farmers because you can't use it for development purposes in the future. So it limits the value of the land. But what we're seeing in the Hudson Valley and what Young Farmers Coalition has been advocating for some time is that we need to go actually a step beyond that to ensure long-term farmland affordability by putting something called a preemptive purchase right or a working farm easement on land. And actually, my husband Ben and I are about to close on this particular type of easement with Scenic Hudson on our farm. And essentially what we're agreeing to do is when we are ready to transition our land to sell it to that next generation, we are agreeing that we will only sell it to a working farmer. So someone who is making more than 50% of their income through farm sales. Because in the Hudson Valley, unfortunately, the bigger factor seems to be folks who have non-farm incomes who are outbidding farmers for farmland. So the land is conserved as open space, but we have a lot of people in this region who are here because it is a beautiful place to live, right? And they will conserve it as open space, but they're not necessarily going to use it as a farm. So and they can afford to pay more than the working farmers. So we need to make sure there are places here in this region where farmland is permanently affordable to the population of farmers who want to use that land.
What about leasing of land? Is that something that people do the same as buying land?
Yes, that is in fact how most young farmers start.
That's
is that
they
lease land, and that is what Ben and I did when we were starting our farm, Hardy Roots Community Farm. We leased land for about 6 years, but eventually we had to move. We had to find land that we could own and that we could capitalize, because as a farmer, there are many improvements you have to make on your land. For instance, we grow vegetables, certified organic vegetables, and we needed more cooler space. We needed an appropriate wash and pack facility there. The Food and Drug Administration actually now tells farmers how they're supposed to wash their produce and even test their wash water and irrigation water and all the rest. So there are and we needed a loading dock, and he just goes on and on and on. And we, on rented property, we didn't have the opportunity to make those choices and make those investments or even get the capital necessary.
In this survey, if you have so many different types of farmers, what kind of questions would sort of would you ask of such a broad range of farmers? I mean, what was the purpose of the survey?
The purpose of the survey was to determine the common needs of young and beginning farmers across the country, because we advocate on federal policy and to make a compelling case to the USDA, Sonny Perdue, our new Secretary of Agriculture, and members of Congress. You have to know what the shared needs are across farmers throughout the country. So that was the purpose, and also to set us up for this next farm bill, which is due to be passed next fall, to help inform our policy platform for next year.
So what kind of questions does that mean?
Well, you know, what are your biggest challenges as a young farmer? And the answer we got was number one, land access, number two, student loans, number three, labor, and number four, health insurance. So as I said before, land access is a challenge that is shared by farmers here and across the nation.
And health insurance for both the farm owners and their employees? Or?
Well, health insurance has been identified as a major challenge for farmers because we are independent business owners, sure, and so have to buy our own insurance. And the ACA has been an incredible and very positive shift for many of the farmers in our network. Number one, because many of them, you know, up to the age of 26, right, they are able to be on their parents' insurance. So that was a very positive change. But also many of our farmers, because they're very low income when they're starting out, they're able to benefit from some of the subsidies and actually have insurance that is affordable to them. So the ACA has been very, very popular among our members, whether it's because they're on their folks, whether they can actually afford it for this first time, or that they just have options available to them.
So you said the first issue was land access. How can you as an advocacy group or the government really create more access?
Well, we were just talking about land, farmland conservation, and farmland, right, to purchase development rights, to permanently protect farmland, someone has to pay for it, for those rights. And the federal government actually provides 50% matches for the purchase of development rights on farmland across the country. So one of our primary asks in this next farm bill is that they target that funding for conservation easements, that they target it towards these kind of conservation easements that I was just talking about, that keep farmland permanently affordable to farmers. This is a practice that's being done now here in New York State and in more places across the country, and we really need USDA to also encourage more land trusts and municipalities to use this type of easement, because it is so much more effective at keeping working lands in the hands of farmers.
So, it went right out of my head. Sorry.
Oh, let me catch it.
There, you got it?
Yeah.
I know what I was going to say. So you probably work closely with the Columbia Land Conservancy.
We have worked with the Columbia Land Conservancy, and they have provided a lot of leadership specifically on land access for young and beginning farmers. They have a great land linking program that has helped many of our Hudson Valley chapters find their first farm to start on, and those leasing agreements. They are also initiating more working farm easements, more preemptive purchase rights, these type of easements that we're talking about with landowners at this time as well. So they are really a leader in this space and have been working with us for some time on trying to move the whole field of conservation in this direction of looking after the land, but also looking after the farmer.
So what age were you when you started farming?
Well, I grew up in Columbus, Ohio. So,
university town.
It is a very much a university town. I actually didn't really start farming or thinking much about agriculture until after college. I went to college in the city and moved to Brooklyn after school and started a community garden there, the Red Shed Community Garden, and started learning a lot about local agriculture. And actually, that's where I met my husband, Ben, building this community garden in Williamsburg. And he had just come back from an apprenticeship on an organic farm, Salvia Island Organics, outside of Portland, Oregon, and is originally from New York City, and moved back to be near family and, you know, work at some NGOs and, you know, find his own path, but really wanted to be farming. And so he had the opportunity to move up here in 2004 and work originally in a partnership at Hardy Roots. And then I came up to go to grad school at Bard, and I guess the rest is history. But yeah, so post college, really when I was in my early 20s is when I started to learn more about local food and farming.
How is Bard's farming program?
Well, they have a great student farm now. I studied environmental policy their master's program in their Center for Environmental Policy, which is a great program. And agriculture was a component of that. Jennifer Phillips from Gansevoort Farm is one of the professors there. So she was able to really integrate that into the curriculum. And the Bard Farm program, I think, is actually inspiring quite a few Bard graduates to become farmers. In their latest alumni magazine, they had a whole spread of all of the farmers who have come from Bard College. We're finding at Young Farmers Coalition that many college graduates, folks who are studying an array of fields. I mean, my husband studied anthropology, that they are coming to farming post-college, even though they haven't studied it in undergraduate, because they're interested in getting engaged in the good food movement and being part of that and seeing farming as a way to be an entrepreneur and really give back to their community. And they're learning farming along the way and doing apprenticeships and courses after school.
So I take it some of the issues you discovered in your survey are ones that also affected you when you and your husband were starting your own farm. I assume Bard was not inexpensive, so you had debts from that, and that's why you've heard from others too that it's very hard to begin something that begins with a lot of time and money invested and not a huge return, right? I mean, you don't really start making a ton of money from the start, right? I mean,
that's right. Our farmers are usually making a fairly limited income in their first years, and student loans have come up as an issue across the country for a couple of reasons. Number one, of course, and for an entire generation, in fact, paying back student loans at the given interest rates and the dollar figures that graduates are coming out with. I mean, it is very challenging in those early years. Farmers have a unique situation in that they are also trying to capitalize businesses and risky businesses at the same time. And so we are unfortunately seeing that farmers are looking for loans to capitalize their farms, to buy that first tractor or land or whatever it may be, and are being turned down for credit because they have pre-existing student debt. So that is why farmers have student debt as a, I would say, unique challenge in building their farm careers.
What do you farm at your farm? You said organic fruits and vegetables?
That's right. So we have 70 acres. It's on Route 9 in Claremont. And 40 acres are certified organic vegetables in rotation. In a given season, we'll do 20, 25 acres of vegetables. But that's 40 acres of cultivated land. And then each season, we grow about 15 feeder pigs for pork and bacon. And then we have about 1,000 laying hens right now that are on pasture. So if you drive by the
1,000 hens.
Do you not that many, them? Actually, when by comparison.
Do you go out and count them every morning?
I haven't counted them recently, but we have around 1,000, we'll just
and
say.
How many people do you need to employ to run a farm that size?
So we employ 10 people a season, and during the wintertime, we have 4 or 5 people on staff that are year-round. We're looking to find ways to keep more of our staff employed all year-round, because it's easier on them and it's easier on us, too, to have the same crew with us. We have some great people.
One of the your survey identified labor as one of the issues. I forget what you said exactly, but
it is one of the top issues, finding adequate labor.
Finding adequate
right.
labor. Because
there are not enough young people and people in general who want to work on farms,
right.
who are turning to looking for a career in agriculture. And it is a major challenge to find adequate staff for a farm.
Is it possible to pay like an adequate wage compared to, I mean, let's face it, the past has involved a lot of migrant workers mm-hmm. who were basically underpaid and paid off, you know, whatever. Is it possible to run a farm and pay a fair wage?
Well, we certainly try to, and I think, you know, we are very competitive when it comes to wages. It is possible, and consumers have to anticipate that those costs will be rolled into what mm-hmm. we're paying at the farm market or even at restaurants. Or
right.
whatnot.
I mean, I remember reading something that Michael Pollan wrote where he said, you know, we talk about Americans not wanting to do these jobs, but if we were paying what should properly be paid for properly raised produce and fruit and everything, it would be a fair wage. It's the agribusiness which undercuts the wages spent paid on agricultural work.
Well, I think that there is an impression among farmers that they can only charge so much for their produce mm. or their meat in particular. I think that the difference is the most stark between what you'll see at the grocery store and what we sell mm. our pork for instance. And there's a lot that goes into that. Of course, one thing is how we're raising our animals. Mm-hmm. We're raising them on pasture. We're giving them a lot of room. We're moving them around and we're actually using conventional feed. So but we're not buying it in such bulk. But the big difference really is in the processing and how much we pay for that compared to a much larger meat processor and producer.
I guess the bigger question is, you think it's imaginable that organic and, you know, properly, we'll call it properly processed meat products and things like that, whatever sort of meet the cheap prices you can find in the average supermarket?
I don't know how they could.
Mm. Yeah.
There's so much vertical integration, particularly in the livestock market, between the...
You mean the mass market level?
In the mass market yeah. level, between the contracted farmers raising animals in confinement to how those animals are then processed and then put on, you know, finding their way to the grocery store. It's
right.
that is it's a well-oiled,
it's
a highly efficient machine, right? And
yeah.
and it works very well for what it is. And farmers like Ben and I, we all of those steps we're doing ourselves. And I think
sure.
that there is opportunity for farmers. And we see this in some of the cooperatives and so on from upstate that, you know, serve even the Hudson Valley and New York City. There's some aggregation that can help to bring down prices and some scale that can help to bring down prices. But as I see it, you know, local and organic on at least livestock will always likely, or for the foreseeable future, is going mm-hmm. to be more expensive because many of the costs of a
sure.
larger scale operation, whether they're environmental or whatnot, the consumer is not paying for those. They're
right.
they're being paid by those local taxpayers in whatever state those animals are being grown and by the people with their health and health bills and whatever it may be.
Federal subsidies for certain things that you
so,
can't compete with that.
So it's very hard for particularly on livestock
yeah.
for us to compete. However, I would say on vegetables, particularly consumers who are purchasing vegetables through like a community supported agriculture CSA type subscription, we are often very competitive with the grocery store and oftentimes
mm-hmm.
less than the grocery store. And we're able to do that because CSA gives farmers a unique opportunity to really be competitive because we know what our market size is right at the outset of the season,
mm-hmm.
and we can tailor our production to meet that demand, and so we can be highly efficient.
Mm-hmm.
CSA, compared to farmers markets, it really allows the farmer to be that much more efficient and also hopefully give a better deal to the consumer. But I think on vegetables, we are able to get much closer than on livestock.
You're making me feel guilty. I gave up my CSA.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I know you have one, don't you, Ellen?
No.
No? Oh, you like going to the farmer's market. That's
I
your
do,
big social occasion of the week.
That's right. But also, it's just me and two cats, and right. so it makes it difficult to use. Everyone talks about the overload of greens, especially, that they get during the summer. Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful. But,
it is wonderful. And if you have a family, it's really fantastic.
And
although I did occasionally get a vegetable, I had no clue what it was or how to cook it.
But that's the best part, right?
Right?
What
now.
Is this? Yeah. Kohlrabi or whatever it might be.
Kohlrabi is pretty
expands.
Weird looking. Looks like
exactly.
it came from another planet.
But I did get great meat from mine. The meat was fantastic.
It completely depends on the CSA and the family, whether it's a good fit. But CSA farmers are always looking to innovate themselves and make the model more flexible to what people want.
Well, the Cashin family does this interesting thing where they have a root vegetable sale at the end of the season, and they will store whatever you buy. They'll store it at the farm, and you can go pick up your potatoes or
you
carrots
don't keep,
or turnips.
A root cellar?
No, I don't.
You don't?
Most people don't, I think, in this day and age. I grew up where
next
there
to
was
the coal.
A root cellar.
Down there where they keep your coal.
Sure. Back by the coal chute.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ellen.
Nothing.
So, Lindsay, the survey, the results are basically to decide what then you should lobby for. With government, I mean, is that really the outcome of this survey?
That's right. Yes, it helps us figure out what we should do in this next farm bill and what the next generation of farmers needs, and be able to communicate that with data to Congress.
The farmer is known as the backbone of the nation, according to what my father used to say. I mean, what we couldn't exist without.
No, we
farmers,
can't. Not,
and we need to
not unless you
want to
eat that Soylent stuff. And I don't mean from the movie. You know that new. There's somebody. It's amazing to me that one of these Silicon Valley nerds came up with a perfect food called and he named it Soylent, which is pretty bizarre. You know the movie, right, Ellen?
No, I don't.
Soylent Green is people. That was the big, you know, reveal. You know the movie?
I don't.
Oh my God!
Nobody well.
You know Clark Keston when he goes, Soylent Green is people. This is what they're feeding, and it turns out they're making it from human body. Anyway, it's a great sci-fi movie. It's a great sci-fi movie.
You know, I met Sophie.
It's called Soylent Green, by the way.
Sophie Akoff.
Uh-huh. Yeah, our national field director.
Yeah, and she was at a conference that the Citizens Climate Lobby gave, talking about how to rejuvenate your soil.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting and I think very valuable for a lot of people. And isn't there some talk about giving tax credits or something for rejuvenating your soil? I mean, I'm not very good at expressing and I'm not sure I'm using the right words to say what it is. But
that's right. Assembly Member Dede Barrett from... across the street, right here in Hudson. She is working on a bill in the legislature that would give tax credits or some sort of support to farmers who are using carbon-friendly practices on their farm. So that might be cover crops, as an example, practices that are helping soil to sequester carbon and to fight climate change.
Mm-hmm. I remember my father, who had a big garden, planted peanuts. This was in Broome County, upstate New York, real upstate, more upstate than we are here.
Not that far.
And he planted these acres that used to have corn with peanuts. And there is no way you can grow peanuts in Broome County, really. But, you know, when asked why he was doing this, he said it put, I think it was nitrogen back in the soil.
It's a legume, so it fixes nitrogen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How many years do you have to plant peanuts to make it pay off?
Well, I don't know that I can answer that question. Corn, someone could answer that question, not me. Corn uses a lot of nitrogen, so it would very much depend on what your goals were and if you wanted to plant corn every year. But many farmers plant peas and other types of legumes to help to improve their soil. So Assemblymember Barrett is wanting to reward farmers and thank them and provide incentive for them to continue to build soil and to build soil that improves really our agricultural wealth here in this region, but also to indicate how it's making an impact on climate.
We're talking, if you've just tuned in, to Lindsay Lesher-Shoot, who is here representing the National Young Farmers Coalition. I'm Tom DiPietro. That other voice you hear is Ellen Thurston. It's Thursday afternoon show. Another question I wondered, do you serve in an advisory fashion to like farmers in terms of technical things like Ellen was asking? I mean, like,
so we do technical support for farmers in a few areas. Mm-hmm. We provide classes on how to buy land and how to work with the land trust. We also provide technical support to land trust to teach them how to work with farmers. This year, we've done classes on farm service agency programs. The FSA is an agency within the United States Department of Agriculture that gives loans to farmers across the country. And so we did trainings on that. We do trainings on food safety, and we do water boot camps out west to help farmers understand how they fit in with Western water law, which is highly complex.
But I guess the assumption is someone coming to you already knows things about rotation and all that kind of stuff.
Right. We do not generally do technical support related to practices because we have many partners in this region that are providing that technical support in addition to the many farms who provide apprenticeship opportunities. Most of our technical support is helping farmers to navigate the structural obstacles that they're facing as they build their farm careers.
And how do people find you?
Well, they can find us at youngfarmers.org. They can walk down the street and find us at
the street.
In the jail, the former jail.
Above the
what's
old
the
jail?
Number? It's three, Warren Street
364.
364
yep.
Warren Street.
Yep.
National Farmers Coalition, Young Farmers Coalition.
NYFC. Mm-hmm. And youngfarmers.org is our web address.
Phone number?
It's on the website.
Oh, it's on the website. Okay. So if you're thinking about starting to farm, or you've been working on a farm, want to go off and do your own. In fact, I know three young farmers who started the same way as you did, leased a farm for a while, and now were made enough to purchase a farm,
great.
And now they seem to be doing well. I don't know how you measure these things. I never ask them if they're making money, but I assume they haven't folded yet, so that's a good sign, right? I mean, how long do you go before you decide it's not a working proposition?
Well, one positive finding from our survey was more than half, about 60% of the farmers felt as though they would meet their life goals in farming careers, which...
Oh, wow.
And so that's, you asked, how do you define success? Well, that's how we defined it.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Life goals, meaning... Can you have children if you want to? Can you save for retirement? Can you
especially
buy a home?
To get them out there picking lettuce real early.
That's right. So
they're short. It's easier for them.
Yes, there is a certain degree of skill in farming. But I know I have a 3 and 5 year old, and they're not quite there. Low to the ground, but not quite there yet. So in any case, the farmers we're seeing, they're able to start farms in their 20s, lease land and whatnot. When they're thinking more seriously about whether this is going to work or not is in their late 20s, early 30s, when they think about having a family, saving for retirement.
Sure.
They're getting more serious about their finances and are looking at farming and saying, is this actually going to work out or not? And land access is oftentimes a really critical factor in that, because if they don't have land by then, they are in a more challenging position in terms of how they're going to grow their business and scale it.
Were there any other findings that you can tell us about?
Well, one interesting finding was that 60% of our respondents were women, which is very different than the national national United States Department of Agriculture census of agriculture.
The young farmers I referred to were three young women.
Yes. So yeah. Women are really leading the movement of young farmers across the country. So that is something that I tell people, and either they say, oh, yes, or they say, what? They really don't believe it. And they, think that the women are working in the office at the farm or, doing something else on the farm. But, to think of women as driving entrepreneurs and the driving force behind a farm and the people who are starting a farm in the first place, that is a significant shift from generations past. And is an exciting one. The women in our movement and as members of the coalition are really running incredible farms, and it's great to see.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Really interesting. I did want to mention that you participated in a roundtable talking about with Habitat for Humanity about the need for housing for farmers. That's affordable, as we call it. That was an interesting discussion, I would imagine.
Well, can't they just pop a tent on the farm? Never mind, Ellen.
Yes, affordable housing actually emerged in our survey as a top issue as well. It goes hand in hand with land access. Yeah. And Habitat for Humanity in Columbia County is doing a really interesting and innovative project to specifically target farmers and farm workers and individuals involved in the ag sector to provide affordable and highly efficient housing that can be built on farm
for workers, you're talking about mainly, right?
Well, or owner operators or farmers as well, okay. Or people who are in sort of associated careers in agriculture. So they have an application process right now for farmers who may be interested in the opportunity to build a home on their farm or nearby, and be able to help in the process of building that that home.
I see. That's funny because I always think of a farm as coming with a house and barn,
Well, it would be, I think most of the farmers in our network would be thrilled to have a house and barn to start with, but sometimes that house and barn are what make the land unaffordable.
Yeah,
so
right.
Having land without any improvements on it is also a route that farmers go sometimes to just buy land.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us? All this fascinating stuff.
We've been talking to Lindsay Lesher-Shute, the National Young Farmers Coalition.org, if you want to see it online to follow up what we've been discussing. And thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome.